Okay, so we're pleased to have Travis Maxfield from Chicago tell us about a landscape of field theory. All
right. Thank you very much for having me. Be here. So I want to tell you about some work that has not shown up yet, hopefully in the next month. We've got a whole month to do it. With Daniel Robbins and Saab Sethi. The basic idea in this work will be that despite the recent proliferation of supersymmetric field theories and that are on or associated to curved manifolds, we'd like to argue that a vast and uncharted territory remains. And the reason is that there's a generalization from string theory fluxes towards in the various constructions of field theories on curved manifolds, and I'd like to explore that a little bit. Now, we're all explorers, so I don't think we really need any further motivation for going out and seeing what's new out there, but if you do need more motivation, I think it's important, or it's easy enough to say that all of the excursions into looking at field theories on curved manifolds have yielded many insights, both into the field theories themselves, as well as into the pure math associated with the backgrounds. For example, just going sort of chronologically, some time ago there was topological field theory, which taught us about pure math things, four-manifold invariants. In the intervening time, there's been geometric engineering of interesting and practical field theories, which come about from string theories in various backgrounds and various limits. And much more recently, there's been a huge influx of calculations of indices and partition functions of theories on curved backgrounds, as well as finding dualities from compactifications. There's a graphical example of such a thing, where one takes, say, a field theory compactified on a product of two manifolds and looks at them in the limit where one manifold gets very small, and says that that's dual to the limit where the other manifold gets very small. And this has been a very productive area in the field in the last number of years. So I think there's plenty of reason to explore it further if there's a claim that there is more to explore, and that's what I'd like to convince you of. So in the process of this, it's nice to have an example going through just to keep in our heads. And the example I'm going to draw on is the one that we've been focusing on as well. So it's going to be coming about from a particular six-dimensional theory with maximal supersymmetry called the 2-0 theory. It's been called the Emperor Palpatine of theories as well, if that helps you visualize it. This theory comes about as the low energy limit of a single M5 brain in M theory. And for a single M5 brain, we can actually talk about the fields that live on it, in which case they come in, there are three different types of fields. There's a two-form B2 whose field strength is self-dual, and that's called a chiral two-form. There are five scalars which transform as a vector under an SO5 global symmetry, telling you where the M5 brain is and the five directions transverse to it, as well as four chiral fermions theta. And since I'm telling you about field theories on curved backgrounds, one could generally take this six-dimensional field theory and put it on some sort of background, but not always preserving supersymmetry. There's a particular example that we'll come back to as well later that I want to explain now, in which comes about from a particular string/M-theory duality. So in particular, it's known that M-theory, when compactified on a K3 surface, is dual to the heterotic string theory compactified on a three torus, and one particular realization of that duality is that the heterotic string itself is realized by an M5 brain wrapping the K3. So in that case, right, the K3 is four-dimensional, the M5 brain is a six-dimensional world volume. What results is two flat dimensions, which is the world volume of the heterotic string. So let's see that in just some more detail, because it will be important later. So to talk about the two-dimensional field theory which results from wrapping the M5 brain on the K3, we want to take all of the fields on the M5 and restrict to their zero modes along the K3. So one specific case of that is taking the three-form H3 And we compactified on the harmonic two forms of the K3 surface. With respect to the K3, those come in two forms, either anti-self-dual or self-dual. And when combined with the self-duality of the three-form H3, this gives us in two dimensions chiral bosons, left-moving and right-moving. And because of the number of anti-self-dual and self-dual forms on the K3, we get 19 left-moving bosons and 3 right-moving bosons. And these, in fact, describe the moduli space, which is this particular coset, and happens to be the moduli space, or not just happens to be, it is demanded by this duality. This is the moduli space of a heterotic string compactified on the three torus. And since it is just a three torus, the world volume theory of this heterotic string is a free theory, and we'll see what happens when. So this will be an example to keep in mind when I start talking about fluxes and the generalization, and we'll come back to this later to see how this has changed in that case. All right, so now with an example in our minds, we'd like to go back to some more generality, and we talk about preserving supersymmetry when we place a theory on a curved manifold. So how do we do that? There's sort of 3 degrees of generalization, which have also come about chronologically, and I want to go through each of them and just examine some of the pertinent details to see where and how this generalization that I claim can be done will come in. So the first one, which I've called the existence of a killing spinner, comes about in the following way. So suppose you have some sort of supersymmetric field theory, your favorite one, maybe the 2-0 theory, and you decide to put it on some curved background. The simplest way to do that is just to minimally couple it to a background metric and ask, is supersymmetry still preserved? And the answer generically is no, unless you can find a spinner epsilon which is parallel in that background, or is a killing spinner with a particular eigenvalue of 0. Now this is quite a restrictive condition. We know of some canonical examples like Minkowski space and tori, but more generally this condition requires spaces of special holonomy, such as Kaladiaus and G2s, etc. And we'd like to generalize this more, and we've seen already that it's possible to put field theories on less restrictive backgrounds. So that gives us to the next method of putting a field theory on a curved background, which is to relax the condition of special holonomy a little bit by incorporating background global symmetries. That is to say that if it happens that the spinner parameter associated with supersymmetries is charged under some set of global symmetries, then we can couple it to a background for those global symmetries, here a gauge field A mu, and rather than just demanding that the spinner be parallel, it in fact has to satisfy this modified killing spinner condition, which includes the background gauge field. So if we choose the gauge field such that it cancels the spin connection on the background, then we can solve this equation and find just constant spinners, which are parallel spinners on this background. Now this is precisely the topological twisting method of Witten, which goes back a number of years. And sometime after that, it was realized that there's a beautiful geometrization of this procedure, which corresponds to taking brains in various string or M-theory backgrounds and wrapping them. This is my pathetic sort of drawing of a brain wrapping a cycle. But if you take a brain which wraps a particular cycle in some sort of supersymmetric string or M-theory background, then it turns out that the theory that lives on the brain will be supersymmetric in precisely this way. Now this is an important concept here that will be important for us, so I want to make this just a bit more concrete. So we think about taking a flat D-dimensional space. So here D is meant to be either 10 or 11 dimensions, whether you want to think about string theory or M theory. And we put a P brain, which has a P plus 1 dimensional world volume, in that flat D-dimensional space. And the Lorentz group of the D-dimensional space, which is this SOD minus 1, comma 1, then gets broken by the presence of the P brain into an SOP, comma 1, the Lorentz group, which is on the world volume of the brain, as well as the Lorentz group, which is transverse to the brain, and that acts with on this gets manifest on the brain as a global so-called R symmetry. If we would then like to put in a background metric in D dimensions, one can think of this as coupling the theory on the brain to both a gauge field with respect to the world volume Lorentz, as well as with respect to the global R symmetry, a background gauge field. Or globaling, coupling the theory to a background with respect to the symmetry currents associated with each of these symmetries. And it so happens then that supersymmetric world volumes will be those for which the, or in fact, even more so, the world volumes that result from supersymmetric backgrounds in D dimensions will be those world volumes for which the backgrounds of these two global symmetries will cancel on the brain. Now, the way that I've described this, it's clear that this is an on-shell approach, right? This is coming from a on-shell string or M-theory background in your D dimensions. And in particular, the backgrounds, which couple to these symmetry currents, they solve the D-dimensional supergravity equations of motion. Or, you know, in this case, if we're talking about just pure metric in D dimensions, the equation of motion is just Ricci flatness. And it turns out that these backgrounds then cancel in that case. In the last few years, in the last few years, a further generalization of this was systematized by Festuccia and Seiberg. In this case, one thinks about coupling a background, coupling your supersymmetric field theory to an off-shell P plus one dimensional supergravity. So here P plus one dimensions is, again, the dimension of the field theory you're considering. So this doesn't require appealing to any higher dimensional string or M theory background. It's purely working in the dimension of the field theory you're interested in. So you take the particular P plus one dimensional field theory and couple it to an off-shell supergravity. In this case, the off-shell supergravity multiplet contains a number of auxiliary fields, which are related to the background manifold associated. If you're putting in a background metric in the supergravity, and there are a number of ways to do this, depending on how you couple. There are a number of ways to couple a field theory to an off-shell supergravity, depending on what sort of supermultiplets the field theory contains. But in a particular case, which is analogous to the previous cases I talked about in which you have these global R symmetries, then requiring supersymmetry is just the statement that you can find a spinner epsilon which satisfies this equation. So on the left-hand side, we have precisely the same equation as on the previous couple of slides, namely that there's a world volume connection acting on the spinner, plus the coupling to the global symmetry. But on the right-hand side, we have some extra terms coming from the off-shell auxiliary fields associated with the supergravity multiplet. So I want to stress that what I've shown you here is just one of many possibilities. In this case, this is actually referring to four-dimensional supergravities, but this has been done in many other cases as well, and the details differ. But the general picture is more or less the same, that one sees a less restrictive constraint on the epsilon due to the existence of more fields, this V. So this V here is a particular auxiliary field in a four-dimensional N equals one supergravity multiplet, and I'll tell you about that in a moment on the next slides. But an important thing to come from this is that as this is a less restrictive equation on the spinner parameter epsilon, one gets out of this novel manifolds for putting field theories. As an example, spheres, round spheres, metrically round spheres, and various flat spaces multiplied by round spheres. And the solutions to equations such as these and the analogous ones, depending on how you go about this procedure, have been more or less classified completely by various groups. So this, this is a new thing. I want to just pause here to go through a quick example of that
to show you how
this procedure can actually give, or well, yeah, some salient aspects of this procedure, which we'll touch on a bit later. So, as an example, if you're in four dimensions and you want to preserve precisely four supercharges on your background, it turns out that this is assuming that there is a global R symmetry. Then it turns out that the backgrounds that are supersymmetric are locally isomorphic to an R times some maximally symmetric three-dimensional space. The way this comes about is that this V is required, the V which we saw in the previous slide, is required to be both conserved, and then once you preserve four supercharges, it actually has to be parallel. There's particular constraints on V relating it to the Ricci tensor of the background metric, which tells you that the Ricci tensor can be written in terms of V in this way. And once V is parallel, then it tells you that the Ricci tensor of the background is actually has constant curvature, or the background has constant curvature. And with the existence of a parallel vector, then you get that the background is locally R times a maximally symmetric space. So it can be S3, R3, or a hyperbolic space. If you want to choose a free sphere, so you're looking at four-dimensional theories on an R times a free sphere, then you choose this vector V to be proportional to 1 over the radius of the sphere. And so that's just a particular example which comes out of this and gives you new backgrounds which one doesn't realize in the topological twist formulation, or you know, certainly this doesn't possess a parallel spinner as well. So this is a new background which one doesn't get in other ways. All right, so just a very brief summary of what I've said so far. In order to preserve supersymmetry on some background manifold, one couples your theory to some background fields, and those can either be in the on-shell approach, coming from string backgrounds in brain physics, or they can, from the off-shell approach, be coming from supergravity auxiliary fields. What I'd like to propose to you is that there is a generalization of the on-shell approach, which includes flux, supersymmetric flux vacua of string and M theory. And towards the end, so this isn't immediately any sort of generalization of the off-shell approach, but the more, you know, this is unfinished work, I said, so there's still new things we're uncovering, and there's a tantalizing hint of a relationship from our generalization to the off-shell approach, and I'll make sure you stay if you want to hear that, so I won't tell you that until the end. But so for now, I'm going to talk about generalizing the on-shell method. So I include here a landscape of supersymmetric flux vacua. So I want to specify what I mean by that. And this word gets used a lot, and there's many meanings of it, and I'd like to just refer specifically to a landscape which is supersymmetric Minkowski flux vacua. So we're taking string or M theory compactified on some internal space, and I use compactified loosely because it may or it won't necessarily be required that it's compactified, but we would like to take, say, string or M theory reduced down to some flat Minkowski space times some internal space where we include flux, and this is a supersymmetric background. So a specific example here, which I'll be focusing on, is M theory on some three-dimensional Minkowski space times some internal 8-manifold where we've turned on the G4 flux of M theory in a supersymmetric way. So to analyze when this is supersymmetric, one looks at the supergravity gravitino variation and demands that vanish. So this is a this isn't precisely M theory, this statement isn't coming precisely out of M theory, but instead coming out of the low energy supergravity approximation, which is what we know how to deal with. So requiring that the gravitino variation vanish, which is the same as that the background be supersymmetric, we get some sort of generalized type killing spinner constraint on an 11-dimensional spinner epsilon. Previously, the epsilon I was writing was a p plus 1 dimensional spinner, or in the cases we'll look at a 6-dimensional spinner, because I'll be concerned with 6-dimensional field theories. But this is actually the 11-dimensional spinner epsilon. And we see that the four-form flux comes in some modification. And the solutions to this, right, if we didn't have the four-form flux, then this would be, again, just requiring spaces of special holonomy. When we include the four-form flux, these are no longer, the solutions to this are no longer spaces of special holonomy, but they have reduced structure group. And that leads to a study of so-called G structures, or you know, manifolds with structure group G, which comes about from this G4 flux. And there's been a lot of work on classifying these solutions to this condition. And one thing which we'll be discussing is that the field theories, which one can get at in these backgrounds, should have some generalization of this G structure. So there should be a sort of G structures idea for field theories. Right, so like I said, there's been lots of work classifying the solutions to that. One of the oldest that I know of goes back to a paper of Becker and Becker, in which case one takes the internal manifold to be conformally a Calabi-Yau fourfold. So what this means is that we take the 11-dimensional metric to satisfy this ansatz, which is that it is the eta mu nu is the Minkowski metric on three dimensions. This ds squared m8 is the Ricci-flat Kähler metric for the underlying Calabi-Yau fourfold, and this delta of y is some warp factor, where y are the coordinates on the Calabi-Yau. So we see that the internal space is conformally Calabi-Yau, and there's this warp factor between the two pieces. With this ansatz, the flux equation of motion, which we're satisfying, requires that the four-form be of a particular Hodge type with respect to the underlying Calabi-Yau fourfold. Now, not all of these choices of flux preserve supersymmetry, and one way, or one manifestation of that, is that in the low-energy three-dimensional supergravity, which results from compactifying this, is that there's a superpotential in that three-dimensional supergravity, which is related to the four-form flux, as well as the holomorphic four-form omega associated with the Calabi-Yau fourfold. Right, so this tells you that different complex structures on the Calabi-Yau fourfold, once you specify a flux, will perhaps break supersymmetry. So, but what about the supersymmetric backgrounds? So these come in a number of different types, and let me tell you sort of most generally what they are under this metric ansatz. And it depends somewhat on what is the Calabi-Yau fourfold. So if we specify that the Calabi-Yau has holonomies equal to SU4 and not a subgroup of that, or a proper subgroup of that, then the fluxes can either preserve in three dimensions and n equals 2 supersymmetry, by which I mean four real supercharges, or it can preserve a three-dimensional n equals 1 supersymmetry with two real supercharges. If you want to preserve n equals 2 supersymmetry, the requirement on the flux is that it be of Hodge type 2 comma 2, and also that it be primitive, meaning that the Kähler form of the Calabi-Yau 4 wedged into the flux kills it. Additionally, and I didn't put the dates on here, but I think it's interesting to note that this is some paper, I believe, before 2000, when this wasn't, this other class of n equals 1 supersymmetric theories wasn't recognized until maybe 3 or 4 years ago. So there's a lot of years in between these. So I think that's just maybe just historically or sociologically interesting. But Anyway, it was realized somewhat recently that one can also preserve a three-dimensional n equals one supersymmetry, by which when you include a four-form flux, which is of this form, so the latter piece is just precisely the n equals the previous flux, but the new piece is this. Here J is the Kalo form on the Calabi-Yau 4, and omega is again the holomorphic top form. So this is neither 2 comma 2 nor primitive, but it still does preserve supersymmetry, though not as much as before. If one starts allowing the holonomy to be in subgroups of SU4, then one gets even more possibilities. As a specific example, one might be interested in the fourfold to be actually a product of K3s, in which case more supersymmetry can be preserved, so not just the n equals 2 and 1, but also n equals 4, in this case meaning 8 real supercharges can be preserved. So one important point to take from this slide, though, is just that metric matters in these compactifications. And what I mean by that is that turning on the flux gives mass to some metric moduli. So even in the n equals 2 case, where we require that the flux be of this particular Hodge type, that's fixing a particular complex structure. If you muck around with that, then you'll change the Hodge type of the flux, and you will no longer be supersymmetric. Similar statements hold here as well. So, I mean, that's an important thing that was recognized in this paper of Kukov, Bachmann, Witten. But that's important for various model-building reasons if you want to get out a low-energy supergravity with fewer moduli. In our case, when we talk about field theories, it will also be an important ingredient. It will be telling us that it's telling us directly that whatever field theories result from wrapping brains on cycles in these backgrounds will, their supersymmetry and other properties as well will depend on the metric of those cycles. So this is, you know, in contrast to the topological twist of Witten from many years ago, where generically the supersymmetry and other aspects of the field theory does not depend on the metric of the cycle of the background that the field theory is placed on. So this is an important point that flux brings us in these cases. All right, so now it's I think a nice time to step back to our Emperor Palpatine example. And ask what happens to our Emperor Palpatine or our 2-0 theory, and especially what happens to our duality with the heterotic string once we start incorporating fluxes. So for this case, we'll just take the M8, the internal space, to be conformally a product of K3 spaces. And then when we wrap the M5 brain on one of the K3s, remember I said that this is dual to the heterotic string in a dual background, So we'll talk about then the heterotic string in that dual background. So one important thing is that when we turn on a background flux, the 3 form, H3, which lives on the M5 brain, gets shifted according to the potential C3, whose field strength gives you the 4 form flux. So this is completely analogous to, if you're more familiar with D-brain physics, the shift in the 2 form F, which is the field strength of the gauge field which lives on a brain, and it gets shifted in a background NSNSB field to this gauge invariant quantity, the script F. So the script H is completely analogous to that, where it's the field strength of the chiral boson being shifted by the field strength of the 4 form flux. The potential of the 4 form flux. Then when we go back and reduce now this script H on the K3, we get out again the 19 left moving and right moving chiral bosons, but in this case they're now coupled to 1 forms, right? So when the C3 is compactified on the 2 forms, the harmonic 2 forms of K3, it gives out one forms in two dimensions, and these can be viewed as gauge fields associated with backgrounds in that theory. So what we see is, well, now that we've turned on these gauge fields, the theory is interacting. And as I said before, when we turn on the flux, it can have a reduced amount of supersymmetry. So this is just to tell you that these fluxes matter. They're not just some sort of arbitrary, well, they're not some sort of meaningless thing that we turn on and doesn't change the physics. It changes the physics, in this case, quite dramatically. Also, the theory, so this is an important point, that the theory which results from wrapping the M5 brain on this K3 should flow in the infrared to the world volume theory of the heterotic string propagating in the background, which is dual to that particular M-theory background which you've turned on. So I want to say that this is an interesting and, well, so this realization kind of tells you, in a way, how to realize these heterotic backgrounds in perhaps a calculable way. So it's possible to write down the heterotic duals of these backgrounds, at least in specific cases, and to write out the nonlinear signal model associated with the heterotic string propagating in those backgrounds. But it doesn't quite tell you necessarily how to make calculations. These nonlinear signal models can be difficult to make calculations in. On the other hand, if one can do a calculation in the associated with the 6D, in the full six-dimensional theory of the M5 brain world volume, then one might get a different sort of handle on heterotic physics in these dual backgrounds, which are difficult. And these dual backgrounds are generically torsional and T3 fibered non-Kähler spaces. These are the sort of generic backgrounds that you get out from M-theory on K3 fibered flux spaces and so on. There's another aspect here which is also interesting as another example of one particular point in this landscape of field theories, or a set of points in this landscape of field theories, which comes about from wrapping the M5 brain not on a K3, which is dual to the heterotic string, but on some general four-cycle, in which case you get something analogous to the MSW string, which in that case was associated with M5 brains wrapping four cycles in Calabi-Yau three-folds, and had interesting connections to black hole entropy counting and so on. So there should be larger classes of those associated with M5 brains wrapped in these on four cycles in these flux backgrounds. So just the lessons to pull out of this example are that the choice of flux will change the theory on the string. It changes the theory relative to the case without flux. As I demonstrated, it's interacting. Different fluxes will change the amount of supersymmetry and the type of interactions. And so in particular, the landscape of flux vacua directly implies, in this case, a landscape of two-dimensional theories associated with rapid brains on four cycles. So I told you in one particular case how to go about incorporating the flux. So we know how the flux couples into the single M5 brain, but one probably wants a sort of more general handle on how to incorporate fluxes in these backgrounds. And I think in general there would be one way to do that by, like I told you before, incorporating a background metric in a field theory corresponds to turning on operators which are charged separately under the world volume Lorentz group as well as the global R-symmetry group. The fluxes, though, they tend to have legs, thinking of the four-form as having legs either on the brain or off the brain and various combinations of them, tends to turn on operators which are charged under both and various combinations of these groups. And so I think in principle one could go about and take a field theory and classify the conserved currents, which are under various representations of this combined symmetry and transforms non-trivially under both of them. But that could potentially be a headache, especially enumerating all of them and then supersymmetrizing. So for our purposes, I think we'd like to just take a case where the answer is already more or less given to us, which comes about from brain physics, which includes flux and supersymmetry to begin with. So we'll see how the fluxes come into the brain physics and how they tell us that the field theories should be modified in the presence of brains. So now we'll jump into a slightly different topic, which is brain physics and how we get out field theories from that. So in their regime of validity, brain actions are similar to the Green-Schwarz string. In particular, they come about by specifying some embedding into a target superspace. In the M5 case, which I've been talking about, that embedding I call Z is an embedding from a 6/0, meaning just a six-dimensional bosonic space. So 0 here are the number of fermionic coordinates. And that embedding is into an 11/32-dimensional superspace. If we choose coordinates on this M1132, we can write out this embedding explicitly in terms of bosonic and fermionic coordinates, the x, m, and the theta a. And the world volume degrees of freedom on the brain consist of these embedding coordinates, as well as the two form, the chiral boson, which we've met already. Now, not all of these embedding coordinates are physical. There's a number of gauge symmetries which reduce the number of physical degrees of freedom. And in a generic background, the sort of geometric way of viewing these is that the physical degrees of freedom are a set of scalar fields, which are sections of the normal bundle associated with this embedding, the bosonic part of the embedding, as well as some fermions, which are sections of a particular spin bundle of a pullback tangent bundle and so on, a reduced, they're chiral, these, that's what I mean here by S, a reduced spin bundle associated with the pullback or with the tangent bundle. And so these are part of the same phis and thetas which I told you about before, but just having sort of an enlarged geometric meaning in the case of a generic background. And so, of course, you know, the focus of this has been supersymmetry, so I think it's nice to see where the field theory supersymmetries come from associated with the brain. And this is actually a rather nice story, I think. So the 11-dimensional background possesses bulk superisometry, so 11-dimensional or 11/32-dimensional superisometries, which are generated by an epsilon. This epsilon is what I'll call a flux killing spinner, meaning it's just the 11-dimensional spinner which satisfies that generalized killing spinner, the G structure equation, which I showed you earlier. So under these superisometries, the physical world volume degrees of freedom transform as follows. The important one to note here is the transformation of theta. It transforms linearly, just shifts by an epsilon. There's additionally a local fermionic symmetry called kappa symmetry, which is the same one which shows up in the Green-Schwarz string, if you're more familiar with that. And in particular, the kappa variation of the fermion field is also shifted. But it comes in with this funny matrix, 1 plus gamma kappa. So let me tell you what are the things on the right-hand side there. Kappa is some arbitrary spinner field, which lives on the world volume, sigma. And gamma kappa is a matrix, which depends on the embedding, as well as the three-form, the script H, the field strength of B2, also incorporating the flux, as we saw before. And in particular, this gamma kappa satisfies the following conditions. It's traceless and it squares to 1. So 1 plus gamma kappa is a projector of sorts. And combining these two things, we ask, when will the world volume theory possess a linearly realized supersymmetry? And that is the case only if epsilon satisfies this condition, that the variation, the kappa variation of theta plus the epsilon variation of theta is zero, or in which case, which implies then that epsilon lives in the space, so this, I told you this 1 plus or minus gamma kappa is a projector, so epsilon lives in the space orthogonal to the 1 plus gamma kappa projected space. This condition is called a calibration condition, and it was recognized in this work a long time ago. And there's a number of ways to think about it. So, given a particular embedding, so I told you gamma kappa depends on the embedding as well as the fluxes. Given a particular embedding, then this tells you what are the supersymmetries epsilon which can be linearly realized on the world volume. So this tells you whether or not there will be some or any, and if how many, if any, how many supersymmetries can exist depending on what sort of embedding your brain has into the background. Now these, the supersymmetric embeddings are, so I told you this was a calibration condition, and the supersymmetric embeddings are called calibrations when they don't include flux, or generalized calibrations when they do include flux. And these have been studied in both cases quite a bit. Let me tell you a bit about how about what sort of calibrations are supersymmetric when you don't have flux. So let me tell you the cycles which an M5 brain can wrap supersymmetrically in backgrounds without any flux. So I've taken this table from a paper by Gauntlet, and I've highlighted a few examples that are sort of relevant to the cases which I've been talking about associated with brains wrapping four cycles. So let's take apart this table a little bit here. So in this first line, what's written here is the world volume of the M5 brain. We're taking it to have a two-dimensional flat space times some four cycles sitting inside of a Calabi L4. If the brain wraps, and that four cycle is of a special Lagrangian type, if that brain wraps the special Lagrangian four cycle inside of a Calabi L4, then the world volume will be, of course, two-dimensional, and it will preserve a 1, 1 two-dimensional supersymmetry. One can contrast that down here with the bottom highlighted piece, where instead of wrapping a special Lagrangian cycle, the brain wraps a Kähler cycle inside of the Calabi L4, in which case the theory in two dimensions will preserve 2, 0 supersymmetry. There's another case up here, which might be of interest, say for the MSW string case, which I referred to before, where the M5 brain wraps a special Lagrangian 2 cycle inside of a Calabi L2 times another 2 cycle, special Lagrangian inside another Calabi L2. And in this case, you get a non-chiral 2, 2 supersymmetry in two dimensions. But a natural question to ask here is, now what happens with flux? Or in other words, what are the generalized calibrations? So I mean, I've told you this whole story about wrapping brains on cycles inside of flux backgrounds, and you might even ask, are there supersymmetric cycles in these backgrounds, or are they so? I've told you there's this large landscape of supersymmetric flux backgrounds, but I haven't told you that there's a correspondingly large landscape of supersymmetric cycles in those flux backgrounds. So that's an important step that I want to convince you of now. So I'll make two simple assumptions, and of course relaxing these assumptions will only give you more supersymmetric cycles, but even with these two assumptions we'll see lots of them, a ubiquity of supersymmetric cycles. These two assumptions are the following: that the three-form flux, or sorry, the three-form H3, which is the, you know, the gauge invariant field strength of the two-form which lives on the brain, when restricted to the brain, vanishes. In the presence of a flux, there's a modified Bianchi identity for the script H, which relates it to G4 restricted to the brain. So it's only consistent to set the 3 form to 0 if you also set the restriction of the 4 form flux to 0 on the brain. Under these two assumptions, then, the calibrated cycles are also generalized calibrated cycles. Now, I think that's kind of a maybe not all that intuitive statement, but it does have an intuitive reason, which I'll tell you now. And the reason is that the calibration condition in the absence of flux gives a sort of BPS bound, which tells you that supersymmetric cycles are minimal submanifolds. So if you integrate this particular product of spinners and projection matrices over the world volume of the brain, it has to be greater than, it has to be non-negative because it's an integral of a non-negative quantity. And furthermore, it's only zero, it's only saturated, this inequality is only saturated when you have a supersymmetric cycle, when this 1 minus gamma kappa kills epsilon. And you know, this has an intuitive meaning, just saying that the energy of a brain wrapping a cycle has to be sort of minimized in, like, just BPS bounds for field theories, and that minimization, or for a supersymmetric cycle, it should be, you should minimize the energy, which is just proportional to the volume of the cycle of the brain wrapping that cycle, and so the cycle should be a minimal submanifold. And if we don't have any flux supported on the manifold, then this supersymmetric, and this condition, this BPS bound, isn't modified at all. So this tells us that under these two simple assumptions, all of the supersymmetric cycles in fluxless backgrounds actually then become, when you turn on flux, supersymmetric cycles as well. Or in other words, you just look for minimal submanifolds, and those are generalized calibrations. These are just a class of generalized calibrations. Of course, if we relax those assumptions, there's many more. But the lesson here is that generalized calibrations are ubiquitous as are the flux backgrounds. They're as ubiquitous as the calibrations are. And I told you before that flux backgrounds are ubiquitous, and they qualitatively change the physics associated with brains in them. And so, again, just hammering this point home, there is a landscape of field theories which reflects this. And in particular, this landscape of field theories can be sort of classified by a combination of the calibration condition as well as the 11-dimensional supersymmetry condition, which gives you this sort of G structure condition on the field theories. So what I've written here is just the requirement on a six-dimensional spinner epsilon, which is a supersymmetry parameter for your field theory, that it be the requirement on the background for it to be supersymmetric. So mu here is an index which lives on the world volume. So this is a purely world volume requirement. This is the restriction of the 11-dimensional supersymmetry variation to the world volume, combining that with the calibration condition, meaning the 1 minus gamma kappa kills epsilon. So this is your sort of G structure story for field theories, and one should, from this, get a very large class of possible backgrounds that you can put field theories on. I mean, this is referring just again to the M theory cases with M5 brains, but there are analogs in type 2 A and B associated with various D brains and so on. And so this is the sort of thing which should be telling you what backgrounds you can wrap, what backgrounds you can have supersymmetric field theories in. So I just want to end with a few comments back, going back to the M5 brain. Oh, I've got some time to make this a long ending. So I've written here right now the supersymmetry variations of the various world volume fields on a single M5 brain in a background flux and metric in a momentum expansion. So I didn't tell you what these were before, so let me highlight the differences here between the case with and without flux and metric and so on. So these two supersymmetry variations of the two bosonic fields aren't modified by the flux in the background in very major ways. Whereas the supersymmetry variation of the fermion fields on the world volume gets modified according to these red differences. So let me tell you what these the first two are. This capital D mu is a connection on the normal bundle associated with the embedding of the brain into the background. So recall I told you that these world volume fields phi I were sections of the normal bundle, so it's of course natural that they are coupled to this connection. So you can see, here this is some gauge field associated with the normal bundle. Additionally, this other red term seems to, so if we look at just the index structure here, I forgot to tell you about the indices, sorry. Again, mu and nu are world volume indices. Capital I, J, K, etc. are indices which are transverse to the brain. So if we look at the index structure associated with these two red terms, we recognize that actually this component of the flux, the component of flux with one world volume index and three transverse indices, actually seems to modify the connection on the normal bundle in this particular way. So that's an interesting consequence. I think a more interesting consequence, though, comes about from this little red plus over here. So I had told you before that the field strength of this two-form was self-dual, so there was really no need for me to incorporate the red plus there. But it turns out that in a flux, the field strength is actually no longer self-dual, and it actually picks up an anti-self-dual piece, which is proportional to this other component of flux, this piece of flux which incorporates three world volume indices and one normal index, and it's also contracted with the scalar fields. So this is one of the equations of motion implied by those supersymmetry variations, which I think is very interesting, and also especially very interesting when you think about the reduction down to the heterotic string when you wrap this on a K3, that in a sense those chiral bosons are picking up partners. Also the equation of motion of the fermion field is implied by those Suzy variations, and it comes in this form, so it's something like a modified Dirac equation, where it's coupling again to this sort of flux-modified connection. So this capital D mu with the G incorporates both the world volume spin connection as well as the normal bundle and this flux piece. The scalar equation of motion is for now undetermined. You'll have to stay tuned for when the paper comes out to see that. But I want to comment now. I told you that there were some tantalizing hints to the off-shell formalism, and I want to tell you about that now, and that'll be mostly the end. So the same supersymmetry transformations that I showed you on the previous slide, these ones, for the world volume fields on an M5 brain in a background supergravity with flux, showed up in a paper from, I believe this was late 80s, of Bergschoff, Sezgin, and Van Prooyen, and then very recently showed up in a paper of Cordova and Jeffries. And in that case, though, they came about from a very different realization. These authors, the Bergschoff, etc., they took a 2-0 tensor multiplet of six dimensions, and they coupled it to an off-shell conformal supergravity. It's not completely off-shell, because one shouldn't be able to realize a completely off-shell 2-0 supergravity, but it's at least partially off-shell, such that the Weyl multiplet of the conformal supergravity has auxiliary fields in it. And their auxiliary fields actually correspond directly, one can map them over, to our fluxes. So in particular, the off-shell Weyl multiplet has, sitting inside of it, a an object which is an anti-self-dual three-form on the world volume and a vector in the normal direction, precisely mimicking this component of flux. Additionally, as would be expected, there's an object which is a vector on the world volume, which is an anti-symmetric tensor in the normal bundle, which is related then to the R symmetry. And this brings up an interesting question. If one is able to... So I told you before that what we were doing is generalizing this sort of topological twist where everything is on shell in this case, 11 dimensions. But there's this other story of doing things off shell. So if one can realize this same set of couplings of the 2-0 theory to background fluxes and so on, either in this off-shell 6-dimensional approach or this on-shell 11-dimensional approach, it kind of starts to suggest that maybe there's a deeper relation between this on-shell fluxed 11-dimensional approach and the off-shell approach of Festuccia and Seiberg and many others. I haven't modified this slide since becoming more and more convinced of this, but I'm coming to think more and more that I'd like to conjecture that, in fact, they're the same, that all of these off-shell backgrounds that people, the backgrounds that one can get via coupling field theories to these off-shell supergravities might have an embedding into string theory in some flux background. This is something which I wouldn't have thought about before. So, you know, round spheres and so on, and sphere partition functions really being brains wrapping spheres is kind of a surprising thing. Now, this may very well be wrong. There may be the sort of Venn diagram which tells you the relation between this on-shell approach and the off-shell approach may have some, you know, non-zero overlap, but they may not be exactly the same. So there's a couple of questions then that come about. So if they are the same, there's a question of where is this landscape? I mean, so far, the sort of constructions of the backgrounds that you can put field theories on from this off-shell approach have looked at round spheres and maximally symmetric spaces and so on. But I told you that there's this huge landscape of things which should exist. So if they are the same, there's a bit of a tension there of where is the landscape in this off-shell thing, which is an interesting question on its own. If they're not the same, then there's a question of what is different and why do they appear to be the same in this specific example that I've worked out. Some other questions which can arise from this it was possible in the four-dimensional case to relax sort of on-shell constraints. Is it possible to relax the 11-dimensional on-shell constraints? This certainly wouldn't be an embedding into string or M theory, but one might be able to take an 11-dimensional, it's a maximal supergravity, so this issue is very difficult, but there might be a sense in which one can relax the 11-dimensional on-shell constraints, and which might lead to an even larger class of field theories. I mentioned this before about the relation to, as a specific example, where this might be a useful calculational tool. We might be able to learn new things about these torsional heterotic backgrounds by, for example, calculating an elliptic genus of these theories. In this case, I'm saying specifically, like, take the M5 brain, wrapping the K3 fiber of some complicated M-theory flux background, and then take its two non-compact directions to be a two-torus. Maybe you can localize and calculate that elliptic genus and get out some interesting information in those cases. There's an interesting relation, possibly, to generalized geometry. I didn't tell you anything about this, so this is kind of a out-of-nowhere comment, but there's some mathematical literature on supersymmetric deformations of calibrations, going back to, the reference I know is McLean, talking about deformations of calibrations in G2 manifolds, for example. And that was realized by a paper of Harvey and Moore, which was concerned, it was realized in a physics setting by wrapping M2 brains on co-associative cycles of G2 manifolds and looking at supersymmetric configurations, which preserve, or looking at deformations of the field theory on the M2 brain, which preserve supersymmetry. And one was able to precisely get out the mathematical statement of those deformations. And you know, one could consider a similar thing with these generalized calibrations as well, which can be related in some cases to generalized geometries. So there might be some interesting math that could come out of this. And I told you before that there was that these operators, which the flux is coupled to in the field theory, are, you know, for one thing we saw in particular was a three-form, an anti-self-dual three-form in the field theory, which was a vector in the normal direction. One might want to think of this as maybe coming about being the nodal current of some higher form symmetry. This is kind of a fanciful idea, which I'm just sort of floating out there. But there might be a relation with these coupling in the fluxes to coupling in backgrounds associated with higher form symmetries, which transform under global symmetries as well. So that's all I have for you.
Is there a swampland, since you have a landscape? And I guess more precisely, I mean, you have some class of theories with a certain amount of supersymmetry in a certain dimension,
and
you have this interesting construction technique for some of them.
Yeah.
How many are you hitting, do you know?
Yeah, that's a good question. So one of the statements that's made in the literature on the off-shell stuff, Pastucci and Seiberg, for example, is that their constraints for supersymmetric backgrounds have no dependence on the field theory. It's not that you specify a field theory and then you get out the backgrounds that field theory can live on, other than the existence of some supermultiplets, but it's rather coarse data which you have. So I think this sort of G structure thing. So there's a couple of aspects to this equation. To this question, right? So there's this equation which tells you that that there is some sort of generalized calibration in six dimensions on which you could wrap a brain. So I guess the answer would be that presumably this thing is restricting itself to the field theories on brains or on, you know, various stacks of brains. But that may not be entirely true, because this really has nothing to do with, nowhere in here are the fields on the brain showing up. This is just purely a statement about six-dimensional metrics and fluxes and so on. So it might be that there's a larger class which doesn't depend on the brain setup so much. So I don't know. I would say that if maybe the better answer is that the swampland might be, if these two approaches, the off-shell and the on-shell one, are actually different, then the swampland is in the complement of our approach.
Let's thank Charles again. Next week we're having Washington Taylor from MIT, who will talk about finding elliptic Calabi-Yau out of free-floating models. I have an abstract which I'm circling.